Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello! Welcome back to another archaeo-gastronomical adventure of the Delicious Legacy. I'm your host, Thomas Dinas, and today we're going to go to medieval England. I'm really happy to say that for this episode, I've interviewed Dr. Christopher Monk, who is writing a very exciting book about the form of curry, which is a 13th century cookbook from the kitchens of Richard II. So yeah, a really exciting episode. I'm really excited about this interview because we're talking about all sorts of interesting recipes from the medieval period and the use of all these new exciting spices from the Far East, and that a new exciting thing called sugar. And of course, we'll see many interesting facts about popular misconceptions and myths about the medieval period and so on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the newest episode of our archaeogastronomical adventures. Thank you. Are you as tired and disappointed as I am with the great British summer this year? Do you need your holiday fix of sea, sunshine, and Greek island food? Well, aside from mourning a lot, I can help you a little with some delightful and fresh Greek produce from Malbi and Greek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. The best feta cheese you ever tasted, probably inside Greece as well as outside. The delicious extra virgin olive oil. The fat, meaty olives, as well as the most refreshing white and big bold red wines Greece has to offer from all over the wild corners of the country. And of course, working directly with small artisan producers. Malbin Greek, UK's leading Greek delicatessen supplier and distributor, has you covered. You can shop online and have the exquisite goods delivered to your doorstep across the UK, or you can visit the shop at Arch 17, Apollo Business Park, Lucy Way, SE16 4ET Bermondsey, London. And of course, I'm here to help you even further with your Greek fix by giving to all listeners of the podcast a 15% discount if you go to malbingreek.com/delicious. Then you can get a 15% discount off your next purchase. So go to the website www.malbingreek.com/delicious. And then shop as you would normally do, and you get a 15% discount off your next purchase. Malbi and Greek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. Welcome to the Delicious Legacy podcast, Dr. Christopher Monk.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's nice of you to invite me.
I would love if you tell us a little bit about yourself to start with.
What would you like to know, sort of my background in...
Your background, first of all. So what do you do and your background?
Right,
how did you end up to the medieval Marmite, basically.
Well, I actually work as a consultant. I work as a consultant in either the heritage sector or with creatives. And I'm usually advising them on things to do with medieval culture and medieval art sometimes, medieval literature. But a lot of it's to do with medieval manuscripts as well. So that's kind of what I do as a job. And I've been doing that since about 2013.
Yeah.
I used to teach at university, at the University of Manchester, where I studied for my PhD there and got that in 2012. And while I was towards the end of while I was studying and for a couple of years afterwards, I lectured there on various medieval things. And then I decided I didn't want to pursue a career, an academic career or a career within academia. I just wanted to do something a bit more me, I suppose. And that led to me getting involved in the work I just described as a consultant. So that's kind of where I am at the moment. And I've done quite a lot of work for Rochester Cathedral, and that's ongoing.
Yeah.
Where we've worked with a particular manuscript, or actually two manuscripts, but one of them's particularly important. Nationally, it's very important, or internationally, it's very important, the Textus Rufensis. So I've been helping them understand at the cathedral what's actually in the manuscript and what's significant about it. And we've done quite a lot of work on that and some multimedia stuff, which has been good fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. All sounds very interesting stuff, you know? So basically,
if you're interested in medieval things, then yes, it
of
is.
Course,
I mean, it's yeah.
I mean, yeah.
If you're not, then maybe you're listening to the wrong podcast.
Yeah, I suppose. Yes, if you don't like historical stuff, yeah, maybe it's the wrong podcast for you.
Yeah.
Brilliant, and of course, I suppose you love food as well.
I do love food. Yes, and if you could see my waistline, you'd have worked that one out by now. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've always liked food.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose languages and all that stuff, if you're translating medieval manuscripts and
I think this all kind of, to be honest, when I was at school, I was a pretty decent student, but I left when I was, you know, before I turned 16. So I did my O-levels and that was it. And so I came back to education much later on when I was in my 30s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so I didn't, I had to do a kind of pre-course to get on a degree course. So I did an access to higher education course, which involved, I studied English and history and law and IT. I did for that. So that got me onto a course at Manchester University where I was studying English. And on that course, there was quite a lot of stuff, medieval stuff. So medieval texts that we had to look at. Mm. And then that led to further study because I really focused a lot on the old English. So that's pre-conquest English.
Yeah.
So before 1066, although obviously the language goes beyond that. But that's kind of the very crude, arbitrary division that we give it.
Yeah.
So I studied Old English, and then I started looking in my master's degree and then into my PhD. I was looking, it was more varied. It wasn't just the literature. I was looking at manuscript art and actually handling manuscripts in my PhD especially. And where I was at Manchester, they have a really good library there. So I was able to look at some manuscripts there too. And I had to go to various places to check the manuscripts I was working on for my PhD. And so there was, which were actually priests' handbooks of penance. So there were nothing particularly literary about them. So I'd moved away from literature, as it were, to kind of more, I suppose we could call them historical documents.
I see.
But I had to look at them as well in the manuscript form. And the other stuff I was looking at were manuscripts in the British Library, which were biblical narrative art manuscripts. So they had the text, but the text of the Bible, so this is the Old Testament, they were illustrated or they're accompanied by illustrations. The illustrations are really there first, and then you know, they're paramount, really, when you look at it. But the text, obviously, and the illustrations had a relationship. And I was looking at that and other things as well. Although mostly with those manuscripts, they were too precious to allow me to look at them physically. So I had to use digital facsimiles.
Digital copies. Okay.
Yeah, which is how I mostly do my work now, even if I do get my hands literally on a manuscript.
Yeah.
Such as the one I'm looking at the moment in my own research, Form of Curry, which is a book of cookery from the 14th century. I know I've looked at that and I can go back and look at it, but on a day-to-day basis, I'm looking at it through via facsimile on the Manchester University website.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you don't want to touch that precious ancient manuscript every day.
Maybe. Well, I don't know. I'd like to. But
yeah, but maybe.
But yeah, you have to be, you do have to kind of, certain manuscripts, you know, they're too fragile to handle. Mm. And others are, yeah. You know, you don't want somebody fingering them every day, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. So you started finding food-related things the manuscripts?
Yeah, this was about 2 years ago. I was actually not that well at the time. So I think I wanted to I was just browsing and having a look at the this manuscript called Form of Curry on the website. I knew about it, and just so that your audience know, Form of Curry, it means literally method of cookery. It's nothing to do with Indian spice food. It's the word form means method, that kind of thing, and curry means cookery. I suppose idiomatically you'd say it means how to cook. And this was an official cookery treatise that was written for Richard II of England. And was probably, we can date it to approximately 1390. And the manuscript that's in the John Ryland's Library in Manchester, which is where I live, Manchester, that's the best version of the manuscript. It's the oldest and the most reliable, and the most textually reliable. But also it is a book in its own right. It was set out to have these 194 recipes, and it was fantastic being able to see it in a facsimile form online and suddenly realize that, oh, this is really quite easy for me with some background experience of reading earlier manuscripts. I was surprised that I could pick this up very easily and read it and translate it sort of more or less without having to stop. And that's always nice, because very often when you look at manuscripts and you're trying to read them, it can be very difficult working out what it actually says, because of the way the scribe writes. But that's when it happened a couple of years ago. So until about 2 years ago, I was basically not working in the area of food history. But now I've had to rapidly learn my stuff and get to know other people's works and studies and build on that, really. And now that's the kind of focus of what I'm doing in my own work, my own research outside of the consultancy work that I do.
Yeah. Great. Of course, I know the form of curry. I've heard of it, and I've read some recipes translated, of course, because I don't read
Middle English.
Middle English. Yes, it's not my forte.
I reckon I could show you. Once you get your eye in on a manuscript and work out what the letter forms are, you start to recognize the words. You've obviously got an issue with vocabulary, because the meanings of words have changed to some degree, and the way these quite often there'll be abbreviations in a manuscript, less so in Middle English manuscripts.
I see.
Certainly a lot of abbreviations in Latin manuscripts. But you'd get your once you got your eye in and started to build up your vocabulary, you'd be surprised what you'd pick up. I reckon you'd be very good.
Great. I already obviously translated versions of some recipes, I think, at the British Library's website, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And of course, I've heard of the book a little bit and read a bit about it. And it's fascinating to see the recipes that They do sound very interesting and
in
a way familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, they're not. I mean, Form of Curry as a book, the one in the Rylands, and then these later versions of it,
yeah,
which are more or less the same, but they're not quite the same. There's quite a lot of accretion that goes on, and recipes get switched around, and so the other versions are kind of very loosely, we can call them copies of Form of Curry. But the one that's in the Rylands, and then there's a couple that are in the British Library that, as I said, are later. You know, this is an original collection, but the recipes themselves are influenced by earlier collections. They're not necessarily direct copies, but some of these recipes that you read in Form of Curry have already been around for 100, 200 years, maybe longer. So it's not the oldest. It's quite often, for some reason, and I think I did it myself when I first started blogging about this Form of Curry, it's often called the oldest English recipe book, and it isn't the oldest English recipe book. There are older.
Which one is
that? Well, we have a couple of collections that survive in compilation manuscripts. So they don't survive as a book, as the Rylands copy is an independent individual, rather, an individual book in itself. It is a codex. And it's a very small little thing that fits on your palm of your hands. Whereas these other collections that I'm about to refer to, they're actually inserted into compilations of including other types of texts. And these two are actually, they are English. They date back to probably the end of the 13th century and the beginning of the 13th century. And they're not written in English, but they are English. They're written in Anglo-Norman, which is the French language that was spoken after the Norman conquest. So it differs somewhat or evolves separately from the French language, though, you know, it's very similar. But yeah, so they're actually older. So in the case of one of them, which is in, they're both in British Library manuscripts, but in the case of one that's in a manuscript called Additional 32085, beautiful title, that's over 100 years older than Form of Curry. And then there are translations of both of those French Anglo-Norman texts get translated into an English collection, which includes some other recipes as well, that there doesn't seem to be a source.
Yeah.
And they are actually also older than Form of Curry. And then there's another collection that's just possibly a little bit older than Form of Curry. So there are four texts, you could say, that are English, as in of England, and that predate Form of Curry. But Form of Curry is, up to that time, it's the biggest, the largest collection, significantly larger than the ones before. And it was formerly a book of Richard II, and that's what it says in the opening, in the introduction to the John Rylands library version. That actually says, you know, this is a copy or a hard copy, an official document is really what the Latin word means, copia.
Yeah.
So it's an official document of Richard II, and it was produced by his chief cooks.
So what was the purpose of this book then? It was the purpose was to document the recipes or to instruct cooks around the royal palaces?
I suppose that's open to interpretation. Well, it is open to interpretation. The way I look at it is that it can be both those things. It's certainly a drawing together of recipes from, we don't know how many of Richard's cooks brought this together, but there's certainly more than one, and certainly the scribes that write this down, that are listening to the cooks as they narrate these recipes, or they are copying from copies that have been passed to them by these chief cooks to the scribes, There certainly is more than one cook, and there's certainly more than one scribe, because the handwriting changes throughout the book. So yes, it is it's an exercise in compiling existing recipes. And Richard was known as a sort of a gourmand. He was into his food. He was, you know, he was kind of quite flashy in lots of ways, with his clothes and stuff like that. And he was a very wealthy king. And even though they had probably financial problems during his reign and before and after as well, but he still had a lot of personal wealth. And so part of it is about him having his own cookery treatise, I suppose. But part of it's very practical as well. I mean, I think it's very interesting that the John Rylands copy, which is contemporary with Richard II, so it's the only one that's of the versions of the form of curry that we can say for sure was written during his reign. Because of the size of it, the smallness of it, you can see how handy, quite literally, how handy this particular volume is. And it wouldn't, I don't think there's any evidence to say that it would have been in the kitchen, so to speak, you know, how we would use a cookery book today. But it would have been available to the cooks to refer to as a reference book. And so Richard's, the sort of person that was responsible for the kitchens and overseeing all of that, they would be expected to communicate with the cooks wherever Richard may have been, because you have to remember that the courts moved around. They didn't just stay in one place. They moved to various palaces or castles or whatever. And you could imagine that in each of these areas, there may be a book, a form of curry, and which may explain where some of the differences start to appear in later versions, because there'll be some, you know, add a few recipes here, or we don't want this one anymore. So to answer your question more concisely, yes, it was about compiling recipes, but also it was practical too. That's my personal opinion, and I think it's a valid one. Whereas if you look at the more famous copy of Form of Curry, which is in the British Library and is in roll form, so it's not in codex form, it's not a book, it's something you have to roll out, that's much bigger. And I think the reason that was copied was not particularly practical. It was just a record. A record of a previous king, because when it was done was actually a couple of decades or more after Richard had died. So it was done, done during Henry V's reign, who had a connection, a personal connection to Richard. Richard kind of looked after Henry V when he was a young boy and knighted him while his father was in exile. So I think probably Henry V wanted to show some kind of regard and respect for Richard II and wanted to bring him back into good repute. I mean, he'd had a bad reputation during Henry IV's reign. And so I think one way of doing it was to have his cookery book put into a scroll. And I think that's quite different from the little tiny book that we see in the John Rylands Library.
Yeah. So in terms of recipes and ingredients from the form of curry, what does stand out for you?
Oh, what stands out? What, individual recipes or more generally?
More generally, I suppose. I think
spice, the amount of spices that are used in the recipes, and quite a fair amount of sugar as well, which what's interesting is that people, well, it's understandable. If we think of sugar going into a recipe, we immediately think, oh, it's something that's sweet. But by and large, there are deliberately overtly sweet dishes in form of curry, but not that many. Most of the ones that contain sugar is being used as a spice. It's one of the spices that they had. And it was used as a counterpoint to enhance other spices, or maybe as a counterpoint to salt sometimes, I think, as well.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, that's the range of spices is completely surprised me. I had no idea until a couple of years ago when I started looking into this food history, the things that you could, that were being regularly used in elite cuisine. So you had pepper and black pepper, and which was eventually becomes quite common, really. But it was expensive back then in the 14th yeah. century. But then you start to get things like long pepper. You get cubebs, which are have a type of peppery flavor to them. You've got an awful lot of saffron being used. I did calculate how many of the 194 recipes had saffron. And I think it was about 40%, which is like, you know, they're basically just throwing saffron into almost everything. And I do think with saffron, that's just about quite often. I mean, it obviously does have its own distinctive flavor profile, saffron. And it was quite often used as a food colorant, and it states that in some of the recipes.
Yeah, of course, it's the coloring. Yes, and also suppose.
But some of the time they just put it in there because it was the elite spice to put in, and you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Just because. It's the kind of thing, I think. Expensive, extravagant. Yeah.
Other spices they had, ginger and galangal, which, you know, I'd probably heard of galangal 2 years ago,
really?
But I had no idea what it was. But, you know, they appear. And there's various other ones as well that are in there. I can't remember how many different spices there are altogether, but I think it gets into double figures.
Oh, yeah, there are many. Easily. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just they're very interesting to see that they use ginger and pepper and cinnamon for sure, this stuff. And yeah.
Cinnamon, yes, or cannel as they called it. They had, it's quite difficult to work this out. And I think it's only just like in the last few months, it's become clearer to me. They have cinnamon in two forms. So they've got powdered cinnamon, and then they have cinnamon buds. Yeah. Which I'd never heard of, even though, you know, I enjoyed cooking for 40 years probably now. I'd never heard of cinnamon buds, but they're from the same plant, and they do appear in a form of curry and other recipes. What's quite difficult to understand that that's what's being spoken about is the fact that the word for them is, they use the word fleur, which is means both flour and flour, as in flour, the stuff from, you know, that you make bread with,
and then
flour.
Yeah,
so
it's
you know, that's one of the difficulties of translating things. So it took me a while to realize that there was a distinction being made. And I think, you know, people have done previous studies, like Constance Hyatt, I think she kind of worked that out, that we're talking about cinnamon buds probably. She wasn't sure at first, but then she becomes more sure in some of her later work. So yeah, they had some things that we don't really see in our supermarkets anymore.
No.
So.
Yes. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah, exactly. And
so yeah, that's what the thing that really stood out to me, the amount of spice they use.
Yeah, completely different from the later, like, I don't know, 19th, 20th century cookbooks, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, it all gets very dull, doesn't it, a bit?
Yeah.
I think, really, and bland, perhaps. And, you know, and during the 20th century, you know, you're influenced by foods in Britain anyway, were influenced by the war and having to cut back on things. And so things became more basic. And also things like farming changed dramatically. So things like artisan cheeses just almost disappeared during the 20th century. They're starting to come back now. But cheeses back in the medieval period were probably, you know, had an individual kind of flavor depending on where they were made and what cows were. And,
You
know, what time of year it was. You know, whereas if you buy basic things like basic cheddars today, you've got a pretty uniform flavor, or perhaps less so now. In the last few years, there has started to be quite a range of things. And, you know, and there are some great places to go and pick up wonderful cheeses and so forth.
Yeah.
I think what becomes Well, another thing that really interested me about Form of Curry and more broadly medieval English cookery is how a lot of it is familiar. Mm-hmm. And then there are just some of those things that have kind of, they don't seem to make sense to us in terms of flavor profiles, or at least initially they don't seem to. And then it's about experimenting as well with them, because I don't know whether your listeners know this, but generally speaking, when you look at a medieval recipe, it doesn't really tell you the quantities that are needed. There are some exceptions here and there, you know, where it does, or give you ratios, but mostly it doesn't. So it's about working that out as someone,
as a practical cook, who's in the kitchen, you work it out for yourself. Yeah. Which is, I think we are familiar with the ancient Roman Apicius.
The same problem.
It's exactly that. It's just a bunch of ingredients. Yeah, it doesn't say how. Or how much you
need. Yeah, and it doesn't. Yeah, and it doesn't say how long to cook things for. And there are occasions, I think, when I've read things and I thought, oh, that's kind of killing the animal three times the way they prepare it. You know, it's like and they're also big into grinding everything up into sort of minced capon, you know, a lot of things were minced up and put into kind of rice-based mixtures.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that going on that you see in medieval cuisine, and they're just enlivened by the spices or a little bit of sugar and things like that.
So they had rice already. So in the
mostly it's in Form of Curry. There's one actual rice recipe. Mm-hmm. But there are quite a lot of recipes that involve rice flour. And so you do see that. So a dish like blancmange, which we're familiar with, is nothing like, you know, that evolution happened much later. Probably, I can't quite remember whether it was 18th or 19th century when what we would think of that sort of custardy jelly type thing that's pretty revolting, probably, if I remember right. But blancmange was nothing like that back in the 14th century. Blancmange was a mixture of grind rice and usually something like chicken or capon that was ground as well. And there may be spices and there may be some kind of sweet element or semi-sweet element. So there'd be some sugar put in there. I have recreated some of these dishes at home, and I was surprised actually when I did some experimenting with a dish that involved chicken, ground chicken and sugar. And I thought, oh, that's just not going to work. But I did several versions of it, and the one that I enjoyed the most was the one with the high percentage of sugar in, which was quite interesting. So sometimes these, when you initially read them, you think, oh, this is really odd, very medieval. But actually, it's just about trying, experimenting, and seeing what works. And you know, you can. I mean, I've got quite a wide palate, I suppose you could say. I do enjoy lots of different types of food, from quite bland stuff to highly spiced stuff. You know, food does different things for me depending on the context. Yeah. But I think if you're fairly open minded, you'll find a lot of the stuff is. It's very eatable. It's very enjoyable. Some of it's a bit, you know, there are quite a lot of recipes that seem the same, you know, very similar, even within one cookery book like Form of Curry. You think, oh, how many versions of that do we really need? You know, they only change them very slightly. But there are some very interesting things going on with sauces. So you get a lot of they use vinegars and verjuice quite a lot in their sauces.
Yeah. Yeah, which we don't do a lot.
No, although it's very big in Australia, isn't it? It was kind of really it kicked off in there about 10 years ago. I forgot, there was probably some famous cook or somebody that started to reintroduce it. And of course, I think it's used in
of course.
I'm thinking of the Middle East, really.
I think more Middle East.
Because where I got the verjuice from was from a Middle East shop in London, actually, when I was down there. Mm. But yeah, that's I mean, verjuice isn't as vinegary as vinegar, but it reminds you of that. But they certainly were into using vinegar as well. And their wines as well that would be put into some sauces weren't, you know, they weren't really the kind of, it's hard to prove, but it doesn't seem likely that they were these round, well-rounded wines that we tend to drink today. So you would have a sharpness to them. And we say that because they just didn't last. They had most of the wines, apart from some of the sweet wines, which were really highly valued, but most of the wines that were dry or dryish that came from areas in France would have been, I think, quite sharp, and they had to purchase them every year because they would just go off. So it doesn't really speak of the depth of flavors that you get from the wines that you can lay down for 10 years easily in today's. So, yeah, I mean, so some of a lot of the sauces, that's one of the things that often gets said about the sauces in medieval period, especially medieval England, is that they were really fond of vinegary sauces. And it's said in a sort of disparaging way. But when you actually get around to cooking them and you realize that it's something you can enjoy. It's not that far removed from things that we eat today and use as condiments. So we traditionally in Britain, mint sauce is, you know, eaten with lamb. It's essentially just, you know, minced mints, as in the plant mint, minced mints. It's essentially mint ground up. That's better, isn't it? Ground up mint and a little bit of sugar and vinegar. And, you know, we love it with lamb here. Yeah. I don't know whether you like it. I don't think it's a very particularly Greek thing. I don't know. But
No, it's not. It's actually exactly something that
And so that's an example of something that's, at least in Britain, we're very familiar with. And then, you know, you get other... I was thinking of trying to think. Well, even a vinaigrette, you know, modern vinaigrettes are they're just basically oil and vinegar, and they're sharp. They're no sharper than the medieval sauces. But I think perhaps what we're imagining is that all of the meat and everything that was that these things are meant to go with, or the poultry, the swan, or the the heron or whatever, but also chicken and capon and all the other big meats. I think we imagine that they're somehow swimming in this stuff, you know, swimming in vinegary sauces, when I think really what was happening is you're actually using them as we would use a condiment. So I think that's what we're seeing, really.
I don't see why not. It would be any different in that respect. Yeah, you would want to taste the meat. I mean, they were great cooks, and they had great big fires,
definitely,
cooking over big roasts and so on, you know, on spits and stuff. So it would be tasty anyway. You know, you have a highly skilled cook doing that day in, day out. So it would be a very tasty thing.
Yeah. Or you'd probably have some dog's body actually turning the spit, but it'd be supervised by and they would get shouted at if they got it wrong. You know, you can't present, especially in an elite kitchen like Richard II. This has got to be presented well to Richard and his guests. You know.
Yeah, exactly. And then the sauces were the kind of the ending of finishing the meal, like completing the dish itself and making it more extravagant, more.
You do get surviving. There are manuscripts that survive which actually contain historical menus. So, for example, there is a document that dates to the period of towards the end of Richard's reign, where he was being entertained by Thomas Despenser, who was a favorite of Richard, and he entertained him. And there's two menus that appear, one when he's actually holding the feast for the king, and then there's another one where the king is at his own table, so a little bit more I guess a slightly smaller event. It's just as grand, to be honest. But they're bringing in all of these massive, big meats, as the French would call them, chargras. So you've got your, you know, your venison, mm-hmm. and you might have a boar's head or something like that. But it'll be served with other things as well. So you'll have pottages, which just means anything cooked in a pot. And so that can be varied. But you will have, sometimes you get an idea that these sauces are being served alongside. It's about, you have to read them carefully. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it doesn't really mention the sauces. But when you read the recipe books, you realize when it comes to the sections for sauces, the cook's directing that they be served and eaten with a particular meat. So you serve that with venison and veal. Mm. You serve that with capons. You serve that with swan. And there are specific sauces for each of the roast meats. So they would have been appearing on the table for Richard and his guests to munch and enjoy. Although they wouldn't get to eat everything that he got to eat. He'd get the full three courses, as it were, because they had three courses in a meal. Whereas people that were lower down the ranking would either have just two of the courses or maybe just one of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fascinating. That's something that, we don't consider too much. We don't know. Eight more than...
Well, not necessarily more, but they had more variety. So, and if there are books that exist from the period sort of that discuss the manners, sort of table manners and basically are treaties on how to serve your lord, you know. One of the ones I'm thinking about is actually written in poetic form. But it basically, if we're to take those as being an accurate reflection of how all of the elite ate, I mean, it might not be an accurate reflection. It might be sort of more ideal, sort of an ideal that was being propounded. But it seems that they were very, very elegant and what we would probably say quite fussy the way they serve things. So things would be cut in very small little pieces, and then they'd be put on a trencher or put onto a spoon for Richard or whoever, the Lord, to eat. So it'd all be very, I would use the word dainty. It looks very dainty. So they're not grabbing chunks of meat, sort of drumsticks and, you know, a side of venison and sort of stuffing it down them. That's a kind of,
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That's my preferred way of eating.
Yeah, that's the kind of, yeah, it is funny, the kind of ideas though that we get fed, I suppose, through films and so forth, you know, where we see
popular culture.
Whereas it's very refined manners, and you know, some of this I'm sure was influenced by other countries as well, you know, but I guess at the highest level we're talking about here, or well, not necessarily the very highest, you would, I mean, the poem I've just referred to talks about a lord, so it's not talking about a king. But yeah, that was still nevertheless very careful how things were meant to be served and so forth. So yeah, a king would get to see the whole array, the whole three courses and all the fancy things, and would, if he wanted to, eat from each one a small amount. Others, depending on which table they were sitting at, would perhaps get to see some of these things passing, but they wouldn't get to partake.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose, yeah, if you're the king as well and you have your favorites, you might give something to your favorites.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it depends who you're entertaining, and you know, you might have. I mean, quite often, I think what goes on, a king isn't always going to be eating in front of sort of the whole of his household, which could be an awful lot of people. He'll be eating privately, as it were, in his own chamber, where there may be a few, you know, a few important people that day that he needs to speak to. But it doesn't mean that every time he sat down to breakfast or whatever, you know, he had swan brought in. And there are such things as feasts, and then there are more simple foods. And that's reflected in the form of curry as well, because, you know, you've got quite basic things. You know, there's like something that one of my favorite dishes, I think, I have done this and it's surprisingly tasty, is I think it's, trying to think of it's called in Middle English. It's something like gruel eforced. So that means kind of enriched gruel. So it's a gruel is based on oats.
Oh, great.
An oatmeal. Yeah. And this particular gruel is an oatmeal. So it's a kind of thickened, rich, soupy, porridgey type thing. And this is served with meat, which wouldn't be, you know, the peasants would eat the gruel, but they wouldn't eat meat if they cooked a gruel. And they certainly wouldn't be using saffron to give it that sort of golden hue which saffron gives it. And they wouldn't be spicing it up with the spices. But for the king, he would maybe he's feeling that he's got to show some penance or whatever, because they had to do penance too. He'd have some posh gruel. Maybe that's something he would eat, you know.
Yeah, so you did something like that. So you cooked something like that yourself, and you found it very satisfying.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I'm going to put that on my, because I've got a YouTube channel, and I will be doing that as one of the recipes. The posh, I'm calling it posh gruel, but it's a few down the list. I've got a few other ones I've got to get through first of all, but I will be doing that. Yeah, it's surprisingly rich, because the broth stock that it's made with I use bone marrow.
Yeah.
So that really gives a richness to the stock. And
looking forward to watching the video. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And to say here to people that it's your YouTube channel is Monks Modern Medieval Cuisine.
Yes, I should have said that. Yeah, right? It's Monks Modern Medieval Cuisine. It's a kind of, I've been doing it a few months, and I don't have the time to do more than one recipe a month. If I did have the time, I'd do more. But so I'm doing one of those a month. And yeah, we've done some interesting stuff so far. Yeah, I did some spicy sauces recently. Great. It's interesting for me as somebody that, you know, I've done quite a bit of work for other creatives, and, you know, and they've been able to produce some great interactive stuff for various clients and so forth. And as I mentioned, the Clive Nolan, he's done some fantastic stuff with, you know, a little bit of my help. So it's actually nice though for me. I have a creative side, and it's quite difficult learning the ropes, as it were, with producing YouTube videos, because, you know, there's an awful lot to learn, and there's an awful lot of mistakes to make. But yeah, it's a different way of getting across. You know, I am a scholar, basically. You know, the nitty gritty work that I do for my own research, and when I, because I still do write articles for academic articles, even though I'm not physically in a university anymore. So all of that's very kind of, you know, robust research, and that kind of research is actually feeds into these more interesting creative outlets such as videos. You know, you still have to have that underpinning what you're doing, but you don't necessarily have to bombard somebody with all of the with all of the
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. You do all the research and we get to see the tasty results. And
we can
make them ourselves
again. I'm hoping that what I'm doing with my videos and to an extent my blog as well, maybe even more with the blog that I do, is actually bring a marriage of being creative and enjoying food and experimenting with food, but also bringing in some history that's reliable. I've seen plenty of videos that are done about the medieval period, and it's a bit light on the history or not actually true. Often it isn't accurate. Yeah. So, you know, because people work very quickly and they don't have the time to do that background research or misunderstand things that they read. So I'm hoping to try and bridge that gap. And, you know, I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. I like looking at the way people popularize medieval stuff. I'm certainly not a purist, but I do, for myself, I like to think that what you're listening to and watching is reflecting the actual real history. And if it does differ from the manuscript, then I feel it's important for me to say that and not just go ahead with it anyway, you know. And I quite often with my own case, I'm gluten intolerant, so I have to make things like pastry and stuff that, you know, didn't exist back in the medieval period. So I have to do, if I'm going to eat it, need to cook with some modern techniques as well. Hence, modern medieval cuisine, I think, as well. So,
yeah, exactly. Brilliant. For me, it's also, you know, I'm very curious about how people ate, and, you know, it's part of the history, as I suppose, and I really want to explore the past and, you know, the tastes that people had and how they lived. And food is very central to that curiosity about the past, I think. And, you know, knowing what they ate and how they ate it, it's just fascinating. And we know that the further we go to the past, the less we find in terms of recipes. Yeah. And it's just like decoding and getting clues here and there. A clue here, a clue there. And again, the whole thing that people work tirelessly for years and years finding all these little pieces of information and assembling. I love it.
And I think it is. It's very, I think what I've enjoyed, even in the sort of 2 years that I've been doing it, you know, when I compare where I was initially, where I could, you know, I read through the manuscript for Form of Curry and did a working edition and translation fairly quickly. That was a relatively, relatively quick thing to do. But here I am 2 years on, I'm still refining that translation because the research makes you change your view on things. You think, oh, so that doesn't mean what I thought it meant. And so you're having to build on your own research, but you're also using other people's previous studies as a foundation. You know, the more you read those, sometimes that enlightens you. And sometimes you find yourself disagreeing with them, you know, what they wrote 30, 40 years ago, and you realize that you've got something to offer to move it on a little bit. So I think the history of eating and food and recipes is something that's constantly evolving and developing. So we have ideas about things that are needing to be updated, I think. That's definitely true. And there are a few myths about food. I'm sure you find that there are, and you need to correct those as well, because they're not based in anything really solid.
What your the one that you dislike the most, I don't know, just grind you. Like a myth about medieval times or something. Is it, like we said, eating big pieces of.
I don't. Yeah, there is. There's obviously the kind of image of people with a sort of chunk of meat in their hands. You know.
Yeah,
and that even there is even evidence, maybe even at a sort of lower echelon, that you still people were they weren't uncouth necessarily, you know. So there's that's got to be, you know, something that needs to change. I think if I picked something a bit more kind of a more of a detailed nitty gritty thing, I would say the thing that I find that's something that's being perpetuated is something about pastry. That pastry was never eaten. Yeah. You know, that's something that's often said, you know, it's said in books that are, you know, very, very good books,
right, okay.
But it implies that people never ate pastry. And I just don't think the evidence supports that. In some cases, pastry was a kind of a container, as it were, for it was the filling that was important. So one of my big, it's not, obviously I've not had it for very long, but it's a bugbear that I want to kind of readjust our view of how pastry was made and eaten in the medieval period. And that's just come about from really, really getting back to the primary sources. It's only when you read those that you realize that they must have been eating some of the pastry, and because of the way it was made. So that's kind of my little detail, that my detailed bugbear, I suppose.
No, it's fantastic. It's so much detail here for something that obviously I haven't talked about in the podcast before. So it's great to have such a nice in-depth about the form of curry discussion about it. Yeah, you're writing a book as well now. So,
yeah, I am. Yeah, it's the book is the sort of working title is How to Cook in the 14th Century, and it is it will essentially be an edition of the John Ryland's Library Form of Curry that I mentioned. So that little tiny book, it's just that version of Form of Curry. I'm not attempting to do a perfect edition that combines all of the existing manuscripts.
Yeah.
You know, that's been done before, although it was done and they didn't know about the John Ryland's one, which was a shame that they made that mistake.
Yeah.
And that was done just as an edition, and it's an academic book. What I want to do is present the text, if you want to read it in Middle English, with an easy to follow translation and a commentary on every single recipe.
Yeah.
And there is I've done a quite a comprehensive glossary. So every single ingredient, any equipment, any cookery term, it will be explained. Those things will be explained as you read through the individual recipes. But if you want to go straight to the glossary and want to find out what something means, then you can go there as well. So I'm doing, at the moment, the way I'm doing it as well is that I'm made the decision, it might get changed, but I made the decision that the chapters will actually be split into sections that make more sense to a modern reader. So you'll have a chapter on, for example, vegetable dishes, and then there's a chapter on meat and furred game and offal. And then there's one on poultry and feathered game. And then there's pasta and rice. And then there's sweet dishes. I can't quite remember the number. There's 10 chapters altogether.
Yeah, yeah.
So that means I'm actually not following the order of the manuscript. Mm. So that is something that I had to think about. See, if you were normally doing a purely what they call a critical edition of a text, you wouldn't do that. I'm making that, it's not as a compromise, but it's a way of actually being more accessible.
I think
And you wouldn't normally anyway, if you were doing an edition of recipes, you know, a book where you're just giving the Middle English and then you're giving the translation, you wouldn't normally offer extensive commentary that was about the context of each recipe.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing. It's not the kind of academic commentary, though there's a little bit of that every now and again. There's bits about the language and what does the recipe title mean, because often it looks like gobbledygook and people haven't understood what something has meant.
Yeah, of course.
you know, and but there's often I'll talk about how it would have been eaten or when it would have been eaten or where this particular recipe appears in another cookery collection, maybe in France or maybe in other parts of Europe. So that's the kind of thing I'm trying to do with this book. And it's well underway. It's just I'm a bit of a plodder. I can do some things fast, like the translating side of it. It's not the difficult thing that's taken all the time. It's the extra research. So, you know, you can think of something as simple as parsley, for example, and then the more you look into it, you realize, oh, right. So, you know, parsley was not necessarily the same as we think of it today, and that kind of thing. So I'm trying to explain some of that as well. The idea is it's very detailed. It's not dumbing things down. There'll be lots of end notes if people want to read the end notes, but it is something that a non-expert, a non-specialist can pick up, read, enjoy it, and maybe have a go at recreating the recipes. And I've tried to incorporate that into the commentary as well, wherever it's not obvious, where there's any confusion in the original language. I've tried to explain what it probably means, so that there's some of them I will have, by the time I finished it, I'll have probably experimented with quite a significant number of the recipes, but some of them I won't have done that. But I've developed an idea through practicing with other recipes about what is probably meant, and I've begun to understand terms better myself, you know, what a particular word means and in terms of process.
Fascinating. Fantastic stuff. And I'm looking forward to see it on shelves and read it myself.
I mean, it might be a while before it's out because these things are not quick, but, I have got someone interested, but I've decided that this time writing this book, I want to have a full draft completed before I make a formal, before I go through the formal process of making a proposal to a publisher. So,
brilliant.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thank you for talking to me about medieval cuisine and specifically about the form of curry.
Yeah. Great. I hope it's been interesting. Here.
Yeah,
I hope I don't send too many of your listeners to sleep.
Well, oh, it's going to be brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I hope you've enjoyed this latest episode of our archaeogastronomical adventures. And if you want to help the podcast come out quicker and with more exciting stuff for you, please go to Patreon and help us there. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.